I remember a day in July in the year 1911. I wasn't long in school when a lad came in and spoke to the mistress, saying I was wanted by someone in the hall. On going out, whom did I see but my father, my uncle, and my two aunts? "Would you like to go home with me today?" said my father. "I would indeed," said I, my heart snatching at it. "I'll go in now, so," said I, and said goodbye to Mickle. An egg would not have broken under my feet with the lightness and the gladness in my heart. I stretched out my hand. "Goodbye, Mickle," said I. "I'm going home today, and I hope to see you again in health and happiness." "The same to you," said he, his tears falling. We gave the mistress a farewell and a blessing and departed. "We must go up to the institution now," said my father, "to dress you up, for I bought you a nice suit of clothes." When I heard that, I was so delighted it seemed as if there was no one in the world but myself, especially as I had never worn trousers yet. When I was ready, my father looked at me, laughing. "Faith, you're a grown man. God bless you." Out we went and down the road again. In a little while, we met my two aunts. They tore me asunder with kisses, for women are the very devil with clamors. "Wait here till I get a cart," said my father. "I won't be long." In half an hour he came back with it. Before long I could see the sea, ever and ever, till we came to Slea Head. "Now, Maurice, see your native place," said my father, stretching out his hand northwest to a small island which had been torn out from the mainland. I could not speak. A lump came into my throat when I saw the island. "But how can the horse get in there?" said I at last. "We will go in with a curragh," said my father. I stopped questioning and went on thinking and looking out. I saw little white houses huddled together in the middle of the island. A great wild hill straight to the west, with no more houses to be seen, only a tower on the peak of the hill and the hillside white with sheep. A good gale of wind was blowing from the southwest. We moved down through a great cliff, a rough, narrow little path before us. When I came in sight of the quay, what did I see but 20 black beetles, twice as big as a cow. "Oh, Dad," said I, "are those beetles dangerous?"
"Indeed, my boy," said he, "it's no bad guess you made."
When we got down to the quay, I turned my eyes towards the slip. And what did I see but one of the big black beetles walking out towards me? My heart leapt. "Have no fear," said my aunt. "That is a curragh they are carrying on their backs." And she snatched another kiss from me. I thought of telling her that it was a nasty habit of women, but I held my tongue. The curragh was now afloat, like a cork on the water, as light as an eggshell. In went my uncle, and the way he set her rocking, I thought every moment she would overturn. My aunts were in the stern, I at their feet. Soon the curragh was mounting the waves. I liked it well until we were in mid-bay. Then I began to feel my guts going in and out of each other, and as the curragh rose and fell, I became 7 times worse. I cried out. "Have no fear," said my father. "Oh, it isn't fear, but something is coming over me which isn't right." "Put your hand back in your throat," said my father, "as far back as it'll go, and then you will have it." I did as he said. I didn't like it. We were only a quarter of a mile from land now, with a fine view of the island before us. The beauty of the place filled my heart with delight. Soon I saw people running down by every path. They were coming like ants, till they were all together in a crowd above the quay. The curragh stretched up alongside the slip. I got out. The crowd closed around, all but the children who gathered around myself, every one of them staring at me. And now the men had the curraghs on their backs and were putting her on the stays. At that moment, down the path came an old man. He looked at me, smiling. He came up and embraced me and kissed me and began to talk to me in fine English.
"Who are you?" said I. "Oh, isn't it a strange thing that you wouldn't know your own grandfather?" said he with a laugh. "Come up at me now," said he, taking me by the hand.
The house put great wonder on me. I had never seen the like of it before. It was small and narrow, with a felt roof, the walls outside bright with lime, a fine, glowing fire sending warmth into every corner. I had two sisters and two brothers in the house, so I didn't feel lonesome. When everything was ready, we sat to the table, and a fine, wholesome table it was. My father and my grandfather and my two sisters were talking in Irish, but I couldn't understand them. Now and then they would look at me and smile. After a while, two boys came in, then three girls, and so on, until the house was full. When supper was over, my sister swept the floor and shook sand over it. In another little while, the lamp was lit. Meanwhile, a young man had come in with a melodeon under his arm, and now he struck up a tune. Two boys and two girls came out on the floor, and it would raise the dead from the grave to watch them dancing the four-hand reel. I looked at the clock. To my surprise, it was midnight. I had not felt the time passing. After the dance, my sister Eileen began to sing. At the end of the song, my grandfather cried, "My love forever, Eileen." And that was the first bit of Irish I picked up that night. After a while, my father whispered in my ear, "Ask your grandfather to sing. He has a fine voice."
"Won't you give us a song yourself now, grandfather?" said I.
"I will not refuse you," said he, smiling. Leaning his cheek on his hand, he struck up Eamon McGain, and there's no doubt but he was a fine singer in those days. Listening to him as he came to the end of each verse, I felt a shiver of delight in my blood, and it's no wonder with the sweetness of the song and the tremor of his voice. There was not a sound from anyone, only the cricket, which had not ceased its own music in the hearth. When he came to the end, "My love forever," I cried aloud and in Irish. Everyone laughed and clapped their hands. It was now very late. The people began to scatter homeward, and soon we were all asleep. The next day was fine, calm and sunny.
"Would you like to go up to the hill with me?" said my grandfather.
"I would," said I. We went up the road, my grandfather with a stick in one hand, the other holding his pipe in his mouth for lack of teeth. We walked on until we reached Hill Head.
"Look where your father's lobster fishing," said my grandfather, pointing west towards the Inish.
"Oh, it's grand to be up on that island on such a day as this.
Do you see the house?"
I stopped and looked.
"Oh, is that it?
I dare say you were often there."
"I spent a great part of my life going out to it. Would you believe it's many the day I left the house at sunrise? Myself and Stephen Dunleavy, Podge Moore and Sean O'Carna, for we were all the crew of the one boat. Dear God bless their souls, they're all on the way of truth now."
As he spoke, the tears fell from the old man, and he stopped for a while as if to put from him the catch at his heart.
"And what should you be doing in the run of the day?"
"Killing seals and hunting rabbits." We were silent then for a while until we reached Gusty Gap, with a view now of the north coast of the island where the waves are thundering in from the ocean.
"Isn't it a wild place, Dador?"
"It is indeed.
Do you see that rock below? It's called the Locker Rock.
I was only 4 years old, but I remember well the day when a sailing ship called the Locker struck that rock below.
Only 5 sailors came safe out of her.
We walked on towards the Don to the turf stack. My grandfather was teaching me Irish all the way home, and I was well pleased with the knowledge I was getting from him. I had a brother and a sister, Michael and Eileen, going to school at that time. "What about coming to school with us?" said Eileen. "I don't know. What sort is the teacher?" "Oh, very nice man." "I'm glad to hear it's a man, for the women are the divil," said I. It was not long before the master noticed me. "What is your name?" I told him. "Where were you till now?" "In Dingle." "Were you going to school?" "I was, master." "What class were you in?"
"The 5th class."
"Goodbye," said he. I sat down on a bench beside a fine, gentle lad, a sturdy little lump of a fellow. An arithmetic lesson was going on. I soon had my sums done and put down my pen and looked around. The stout little fellow nudged me. "I see you are very quick at your tables. Will you help me?" "I will," said I. I looked at them and soon had them done. "Would you be my companion every day now?" said he, shyly. "I would like it very much." "What is your name?"
"Tomás Ón Bháin."
Tomás and I were together every day now, going to and coming from school. I was picking up Irish rapidly, getting to know the boys and girls and becoming a fine talker, dependent on no one but as good as another at the language. One Saturday, in no school, my heart was in my mouth for joy and delight. I walked out onto the ditch. There was a fine burst of sunshine. I saw Sean Fodder come towards me, the old man with the loud voice. "Isn't it a fine day, Sean?" "There isn't a day like it this year, praise and thanks to the King of Glory. Don't you see him to the east, my boy?" said he, pointing towards the old man they nicknamed White. A stooped figure was standing under the gable of the house. "If you want to foretell the weather, look at that fellow. If you see his head out, it'll be sultry, but if you don't, you'd better make for cover."
"It seems we'll have sultry weather, so," said I.
"I swear by the divil, you're making great progress with the Irish."
"Ah, there's nothing like youth for picking it up."
"Well, that's true. Praise youth, and it'll thrive."
"How do you like the island?"
"I like it well."
"You'll tire of it some day."
"I don't know that yet."
"On my oath you will," said he, leaving me.